And we will proceed to the next case on calendar, which is Seneca v. Halla.
Case says two of them. Let's do them all. Consolidate.
He's been, I was calling one because the other one, he's got to be on the phone.
Yeah, I know. But I mean, consolidate. This is 10 minutes for both cases. Don't call one case and then the other case.
No, it's not.
You know?
They are two. I'm calling Seneca v. Halla. Separate case.
Oh, all right. And then you're going to give them another 10 minutes on?
Yes. Separate arguments.
Okay.
Okay, the case before us is Seneca v. Hallahan. In the first sentence around, what was the prejudice? He got a very lenient sentence from the judge. It was on the reoffending that two 15-year sentences were imposed.
Consecutive.
And consecutive. The first one around was... So you think that, I just want to understand, I'm not sure, if the judge had been given evidence of the Mr. Seneca's problems on the first sentence, the lifetime probation sentence, what would likely have been available to him and that the judge, you think, would likely have imposed as an alternative to what he actually did?
What would the problems be?
That he's unable to enter a plea knowingly based on his condition. And if that was the case, if he was unable to enter a plea, the court could have said, okay, there's some treatment out there that needs to get, and then maybe after that come back to the court. If they entered into this plea, nobody takes a little time to get back to the court.
What was the identifier that you were looking to that would have given the court, counsel, or anyone else associated with Mr. Seneca some indication that there was this mental issue that he was having?
Attached in our acceptance letter, there is
Thank you.
And there's something I should have liked. What is the reasonable confidence?
We know the Strickland standard. Believe me.
I'm sure you do.
What would the what's the prejudice on the second? No, I just want to say where's the prejudice on the second, the 215 years, the sentencing. You know, aren't you saying that he should have done something? If he didn't do it on number one, he should have done it on number two, right? Presented that information. Yeah. Well, maybe I don't understand the argument. I thought you said when he first pled out, the court wasn't presented with the information that may have triggered a different kind of sentence or treatment, or he wouldn't have taken the plea. Okay, so now we've got that. But that's what happened. Now he comes out, he offends, and he's back before the judge revokes, what, probation, right? And he imposes 30 years of hard time. Now, was counsel ineffective at that stage as well? Okay, and so what's the prejudice at that stage? What would he have done that would have changed anything that we should be looking to?
Well, the thing that happened when probation was on the trial,
you're making reference to certain mental issues that Mr. Seneca had, but the issues that he reviewed were a pedophilia, among other things, passive-aggressive personality disorder. Those could be diagnoses for maybe many people that are walking around the streets today or that are also in prison. They're not necessarily such mental disabilities that would prevent one from being able to effectively assist in his or her defense, or a number of other things that would relate to the IAC that you're talking about. Now, are you saying that, is that what you're looking at, that those are the mental issues that made him so confused, so unable to understand the nature of the proceedings? So you're putting more emphasis on the fact that the state did not follow through with one of the terms of the agreement, which was to perform the mental evaluation.
You sure may. Thank you.
Counsel was arguing that that the public defender thankfully was ineffective for not moving what in Arizona they call a Rule 11 hearing. A Rule 11 hearing is supposed to be ordered by the court sua sponte or at the request by the prosecutor defense attorney, not just the defense counsel. Whenever they have reasonable cause to believe that the defendant is unable to understand the proceeding, they're unable to consult his attorney. Now, what the state court was provided with in this particular case, Rule 32 petition for post-conviction relief was submitted, was nothing. There were no affidavits. There was nothing to indicate that he had any sort of mental disability outside of what was in the pre-sentence report. There was nothing to indicate that he was incompetent at the time. I think what's very important for this court to realize is that the documents that counsel is referring to that indicate that he had, for example, I think it was attention deficit disorder, and there were a few others that were listed of a psychosexual nature, they were attached to the petition for review to the Arizona Court of Appeals. Under State v. Shatter, State v. Sayers, the Court of Appeals can't look at anything that's not provided to you by the state court.
Well, but isn't that the essence of the claim, that the trial court wasn't given the kind of information that would have triggered its sua sponte obligations under Arizona Rule 11? They're not faulting the trial court here, they're faulting counsel.
Well, actually, part of my argument is that the trial court has a sua sponte obligation to move a Rule 11 hearing. And there's a case called Bishop v. Superior Court that states that and cites Grove. I think it's very important to note that the trial court had the benefit, by the way, of a pre-sentence report that indicated that he did have evaluations in the treatment in Washington in 1986. And there was a juvenile file, by the way, that made part of the record, and I attached in the excerpt of the record, from a Dr. C. Rayfield. That indicated that before he was actually transferred from juvenile court to adult court, he was evaluated. And that particular doctor had said that he was oriented as a time and place, and was not delusional. So right about the time when he's going into adult court, you have a doctor who's examining him, and he doesn't have a problem. And the district court, the trial court has this. The trial court has an opportunity to view the defendant. The trial counsel had an opportunity to do so. And there's nothing in the record to indicate. Assuming the truth of these fragments that were submitted to the Court of Appeals, that he did have these ailments, there's still nothing there to indicate that those ailments prevented him from being able to understand what was going on. And when you take a look at the record, I don't think there could be any doubt. Now, first of all, when he committed the offense, he was working at the Discovery Center. He was operating a store. He was approached by the police and asked what happened. He gave a rational, coherent story about what had happened. And that is something that is important under this court's precedent in Woodford versus, Williams, that if you can actually respond during a post-arrest interview in a way that is not bizarre, again, that weighs in favor of trial counsel not seeing any case that people are confident. You have the statements at the pre-sentence report.
Moving to the next stage, I think the thing that sort of leaps out here is the quantum leap. At least it did to me, the quantum leap in the sentence when he, after going through the first round and the judge puts him in for a light jail time but lifetime probation, the judge seems to be, let's arguably say the judge seemed to be sympathetic to the age and status of the defendant, assuming that he was, for all the reasons that you're talking about. But when it comes, he comes out of jail and he immediately reoffends. And so now he's back before the judge on revocation of probation. And are you saying that it would have not been at all relevant to the judge in imposing that sentence to have the attorney present, defense counsel to present to the court information that might cause the judge to look more carefully at the mental state and problems of this young man and get into why there wasn't the agreed-upon, as counsel is saying, agreed-upon evaluation by the other doctor, so that the sentence decision would have maybe been better informed or differently informed and may have produced a different sentence?
I think that there are quite a few events that about 3 months later, he admits the four crimes that you're going to hear about in the next case. And so you have a situation where he's now charged. He's also charged with a probation violation of violating his terms where he approaches a girl and makes a sexual overture. What happens then is that he's actually tried. And he, you know, he is actually sitting there at the courtroom in front of the same judge, Judge Hilliard, who initially sentenced him. This is a case where he was actually, it was recorded because of the solicitation charge. He testified at his trial. And you have, basically what you have is you have a lot of indications that, you know, the sentence wouldn't have been different had any sort of evaluation been made. But I think we're forgetting one very important point. You know, right now we're assuming something, which is that the evidence, this mitigating evidence, somehow exists, and we can't speculate. We don't know what type of evidence there is. Only the State Department is presenting with the fragments of a document that we don't know if it is like that. And what you have is you have him being able to testify to the friends of the court, interviewed by the pre-sentence report writer. The pre-sentence report writer said that he had excellent read. This is actually, I think, the fourth page of the pre-sentence report, the first one. He had exceptional recalls for every facet of his life. You know, the issue of confidence is different than the issue of appropriate sentence. The issue of confidence is, you know, did he make that choice to plead guilty rationally?
No, I understand that. That's why I'm looking at the sentence. The question is whether there were any mitigating factors that were out there that the counsel didn't pursue, could have presented in mitigation at sentencing.
We don't know what that could have been.
Well,
the district hasn't provided the State Court with that, and we're right now speculating.
Yeah.
But I can't tell.
Can I just, in sequencing, make sure I understand? You say the trial in the four that we're hearing about in the next case took place before Judge Hilliard also?
Right, there's actually.
Okay. And then when in the sequence was the sentence imposed in this case in relation to the others, before or after or during the second trial? The trial on the second case. In other words, did Judge Hilliard have before him evidence that came out during the second trial before he imposed the sentence in this case?
I believe so. On December 8th of 1993, Fisher was acquitted of molestation of one of the boys in CR 93-0-1-2-3. That's the same case out of which the solicitation charges came. On January 10th, I know that there was a probation violation report. I believe what had happened was the defendant had admitted to his probation violation, waited for his case to finally be resolved, the other case, and then once it was over, then he wound up in the sentence. If I'm wrong about that, he admitted after that other case was resolved. But what's important is that Judge Hilliard had an opportunity in the solicitation case to hear what he had to say.
That's what I was wanting to know.
That's my reading of the record. The problem that we have in this case is that, you know, we have two separate cases in the solicitation charges that were dismissed by the record. So we actually have three prosecutions, so the timeline is confusing. But in terms of the sentencing, what we do have is we have the trial court already having from the first pre-sentence report all the information about his psychological history. We also have a lot of damning evidence that he is not at all responding to his therapy. In fact, he's quite resistant and rebellious. We have, besides the instance where he went up to a little girl and said, "You know, you want to suck me," we have him committing basically an assault against a detention officer. We have reports that he's raised two other children. I mean, when you take a look at everything you have, you have to get a community sentence, and he goes out and says, "You know, I'm the boy." Take a look at it. I don't see how this speculative evidence, wherever it might have been, could have affected the verdict. It could have affected the sentence. So when you take a look at it, I mean, basically what counsel's point of view is, look, he pled guilty, then after he violated his probation, got 30 years, and that's prejudice. It's not prejudice. He got a very good deal. He exhibited all the symptoms of being confident. And, you know, this is not, basically, his position today is due to his failure to apply. I do want to explain something about these transcripts. The defendant had a right to plead guilty in 1992, the court had told him, given probation, to appeal. And he did not do so. He there would have had the opportunity to have those transcripts provided him for free. In 1994, after his probation violation had occurred, he was sentenced to prison. He filed one PCR without ever asking for the transcripts. It wasn't until the second PCR that was filed, it was after he was convicted in the other case, that he actually asked to have these transcripts made. But at that point in time in Arizona, in State versus Baca, and I think I cited another case in the footnote in the brief, there was no longer a right to direct appeal on a PCR. So in the column, in court cases, he didn't have a right to have that made. But nevertheless, he still had the opportunity to present other evidence besides his transcript. He could have gotten his attorney to file an affidavit. He could have filed an affidavit, which was required under Rule 13.5. He could have submitted all of those medical reports, but he did not do it. So basically what's happening here is that the petitioner is asking this court to either vacate his sentence or go back or remand it for an evidentiary hearing. But the state court never had an opportunity to address the evidence that now is coming forward. And the petitioner had explained his failure to provide the whole report to the fact that he's afraid this is a privilege to get on disposal. The state court has to have the I ask you have another question. This case is very difficult to see. I know that when I reviewed the counsel at Carl's before I left Arizona, they were confused. Are any factual questions?
Okay. I don't think we have any questions. I'm a little distressed that the state finds the procedure confused, but I appreciate your candor. Yes. I think we have your briefs. The briefs are very thorough on both sides. And we thank you. We appreciate the argument. The case of Seneca versus Hallahan is submitted.